So today what I want to do is talk about the revolutions of 1848 and read the chapter. It's not very long. And I want to talk principally about why there was no revolution in Britain in 1848, since there were revolutions in France, in Austria, in the Habsburg domains of the Austrian Empire, what would become in 1867 Austria-Hungary, in Prussia, and in the Rhineland, and in northern Italy, and even central Italy, but not in Britain. And I want to talk about that. But before I do that, let's just think about revolution in general and how revolutions work. And I'll mention this again when we get to the Russian Revolution. And if you think about what you know about the French Revolution in this context, hopefully it'll make some sense. And in the 1960s, social scientists believe that revolutions, many social scientists, not all, believe that revolutions sort of came when pressure builds up and you've got pretty soon intellectuals bailing out, leaving the regime, and then you've got all this tension building up and then boom, you've got your basic revolution. But revolutions don't work like that. If you think about revolutions you know anything about, the Iranian Revolution in 1979 would be a good example, or the revolutions we're going to talk about today a little bit, that you're reading about, 1848, or the French Revolution. What happens is that in the case of 1848, or in the case of the other ones that I've mentioned, is that there is a seizure of power by a group who have come together because they oppose the policies of the of the government in power. But it's at that point that you've got an increase in social and political tension, and it's at that point that you've got that tension really increases, and all sorts of interesting things begin to happen. So in the case of 1917 in St. Petersburg in February, bread lines are very long. There are not a lot of troops around. They're at the front. There are not a lot of police around. And suddenly the czarist regime is just sort of swept away like that. And it's at that point that things heat up. The 1917 things weren't any tenser than they were in 1916, and there's a lot of things happening vis-a-vis the war that helped people mobilize, try to imagine a post-czarist world or a reformed czarist autocracy. In the case of 1848, you've got your basic you've got demonstrations in Paris in February. It rains all the time in Paris in February. It's gray. People want electoral reform, and then the troops open up and shoot a bunch of people. The same thing happens in Berlin not long after that. And at that point, then you've got the regime is swept away. But what's interesting about the revolutionary process is that after you've got this kind of basic provisional government, in the case of all, which is what the constitutional monarchy in 1789 and 1790 becomes, and in the case of Kerensky's provisional government in 1917, and in the case of this kind of moderate republic in France, it's at that point, or in Germany or in Austria, you've still got the monarchy, but that you have all these contenders for power who are saying at that point, we want to take advantage of the situation so that we will have a republic, or that in the case of France, that women will have more rights, or that workers will have more rights. In the case of Germany, of the German states, people who want to unify Germany put forth their claims at that point. In the case of France, people who want the monarchy, the Bourbons, that is the legitimists who were chased out in 1830, they want them back. They put in their claims. You've got your basic moderate Republicans. They're saying, we want a moderate republic. And in the case of Austria, you've got all these Viennese students, and they want reforms. They want a progressive regime. So it's at that point that this sort of social tension and political tension increases. And what the revolutionary process does is and what's important about 1848 is that it brings, for the first time, lots more people into the political process. That in the case of France, my friend Maurice Aguillon has called the Second Republic, that is 1848 to December 2nd, 1851, and really 1852, the apprenticeship of the Republic. because now you've got universal manhood suffrage, all men can vote, lots of women want to vote too, but that, it's not a dominant discourse, but it's still important in Paris. And so you have a politicization of ordinary people. And you have this in the German states, you have it in the Italian states as well, and you have it in Austria-Hungary. In the case of Austria-Hungary, then you've got, you know, Hungarians putting forth claims, special claims within the Habsburg domains, and the national question surfaces in Central Europe and in Italy, where people can imagine a unified Italy, which would mean you have to get rid of the Austrians basically there, and you can read about what happens subsequently. But so you have these people putting forth their claims, and so you have this remarkable politicization. In the case of Paris, you know, the barricades go up, which happened in February, and then the June days follow, which is a sort of basically a class war in which lots of people get killed and put in prison, and massive unrest in 3 days in June 1848. And that's a much more violent confrontation and telling confrontation than the initial revolutionary seizure of power by groups who don't necessarily agree on what's going to happen. But in the case of France, which is, again, the best documented, you've got all these newspapers that begin publishing, because now suddenly you can publish things. And you've got all these political clubs, just as in 1848. You've got neo-Jacobin clubs, you've got, you know, clubs of women, you've got the Club of the Two Sexes, as it's called. And so this becomes a way of politicizing ordinary people. So when men go to the polls in 1848, in April, for the first time, and they elect a relatively conservative, indeed monarchist-leaning National Assembly, but they do so with considerable knowledge about what they want. I mean, they want school teachers, they want credit available, they want the right to vote. And so this politicization, or the apprenticeship of a republic that would finally be permanent starting in the 1870s, is one of the most important aspects of the revolution. The same thing of the Russian Revolution, which I'll come back and talk about. You've got Mensheviks, you've got Bolsheviks, you've got socialist revolutionaries. These are three big radical groups. You've got constitutional democrats. You've got monarchists. You've got people who want the Tsar to have all the power that he had before and to lop off the heads of those people who are against him and that kind of thing. So, and then in the case of the Russian Revolution, how you get from the February Revolution to October when the Bolsheviks seize power is really very fascinating. So that's just a way of thinking about revolution, and you can think about other revolutions that you know. The point is that the revolution as a process brings into play the aspirations of a lot more people. And in the French case, which is fascinating, is what begins as kind of an urban, it's a middle-class revolution of people fought by artisans, as usual, who want the right to vote, ends up in December 1851, after Napoleon's nephew, Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, who had become good old Napoleon III, not so good old, but he destroys the Republic, where he completes a process of repression that he'd already, as president of France, elected on the 10th of December 1848, initiated, but that very ordinary people, peasants, for the most part, but also rural artisans, and particularly in the South, and not necessarily speaking French at all, rise up to try to defend the Republic, or what they called La Belle, the beautiful one, against the rape, as they called it, by the repressive apparatus centered in Paris. And so this urban revolution ends up with over 100,000 people taking arms in the largest national insurrection in France in the 19th century, trying to defend the Republic against its abolition by Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, who would not be able to stand for a second term as president of the Republic. And that's really fascinating, especially, geez, a long time ago, I used to read all these interrogations of people, including the uncle of, or great-great-great-uncle of one of our neighbors, you know, and it's being translated from Occitan, which is, you know, the language of that part of the South, into French by some translators. He's being interrogated. When did you join this secret society? Who did you initiate into this secret society to defend the Republic, the social and the democratic and social republic, a social republic that's going to provide more things to more people, et cetera, et cetera. Fascinating, the politicization of this. Now, in the case of Germany and of Italy, it's a different kind of revolution. It still had its kind of liberal and democratic component. But you had this scene, for example, in Frankfurt, in the Frankfurt Parliament, which was this, you know, sort of basically a lot of professors and lawyers debating long into the night in St. Paul's Church, you know, and they imagine the unification of Germany, what they called then the springtime of the peoples, that the German states, which Prussia, you know, Saxony, Bavaria, and Württemberg were the most important of these states, but all these other little states too are going to be unified along liberal auspices. And of course, they were just dreaming. And in the end, they're kind of dismissed, as a servant who was not wanting to be kept on at the big house anymore. They're sort of dismissed, but they debate far into the night. And the significance of all of this is when you read the chapter on the Second Republic, and you see what happens in the case of the German states, is that when Germany would be unified, and that unification is proclaimed in January 1871 in Versailles, in the Chateau of Versailles, after the Franco-Prussian War, it would not be a liberal unification. It would not be a Germany united by lawyers and professors meeting in a Frankfurt church with what would become eventually the German flag, the colors of it sort of hanging all around the rafters. It would be unified, as Bismarck accurately put it, by blood and iron in the context of the Prussian aristocracy, the nobles, the Junkers, a term you already know, Junkers, J-U-N-K-E-R-S, the Prussian nobles. And that basically unified Germany would be, as some wag once put it, an army with a state trailing behind it. And Germany would not be a republic, it would be an empire. And because one of the things that happens with empires is that emperors can do whatever they damn well please, just as czars can. And you might have had an assembly called the Reichstag, which had which socialists became the leaders or the most dominant numerically by 1914, but power rests in the hands of a thoroughly irresponsible, intellectually lazy, sort of madcap, ridiculous guy who happens to be the Kaiser Wilhelm II. And so over the long run, the cost to Europe of that fact would be, in retrospect, given what happens in the 20th century, which is the one that follows the 19th, would be one thing that you know, historians would go back and say very very obvious things, sort of cliches like, well, in 1848, history in Germany reached its turning point and failed to turn, that Germany unification would not come because of professors and liberals and, you know, merchants in Hamburg and this sort of thing, and that the middle classes, the German middle classes, would in a way abdicate their political responsibility and not having much political power, and the state would be really run by a bunch of Junkers, of military officers with dueling scars and veterans of the fraternities of the Prussian universities. And Prussia wasn't just Pomerania and Brandenburg and sort of the marshes of northeastern Europe, but Prussia also controlled the Rhineland. But the kind of magnates of industrializing Prussia were not going to be the ones who are running the show. In the case of Italy, I mean, the news you could read about that too is that there are a lot of people running around saying "Long live United Italy" and all of this business, but that would be very hard too, because in order to unify Italy under any auspices, and most people wanted under liberal auspices, you have to get rid of who? You have to get rid of the Austrians, because the Austrians control much of almost all of northern Italy and much of central Italy too. So there are lots of impediments to Italian unification, not the least of which was the fact that the vast majority of people in Italy did not speak Italian. That itself was not a not a, you know, a major impediment, but it, you know, I guess it was too. Only about 4 or 5% of the people in Italy spoke what now is considered to be Italian, which I guess is, I don't speak Italian, but I guess is essentially the language of Tuscany, the area around Florence. And they spoke all sorts of other dialects, and the Tuscan language was virtually unknown in the south of Italy or in Sicily, and was identified with, you know, sort of money-grabbing tax collectors coming down from the north. And so after the tide of the springtime of the people, or as somebody once called the Great Illusion also, of 1848, after that tide had passed, what you had is still lots of fervent hopes and dreams that Italy was going to be unified along liberal auspices, and indeed that is what happens, even though it's a monarchy, and unification comes because of basically the expansion of the state of Piedmont, Sardinia, which was that most influenced by the French wave in the times of the French Revolution and of Napoleon, and also the wealthiest part of Italy. In the case of Austria, you know, Austria-Hungary, well, I mean, this is a long story, and you can read about it, but the springtime of the peoples meant the dreams first of number of nationalities, and I'll talk about nationalism in a week or two, who suddenly think that now they too will have their time, and somebody, people, a bunch of Czech nationalists were sitting in a room rather like this, and somebody looked up and said, Jesus, if this ceiling collapses, that's the end of the Czech national movement. And there was something to that. So the springtime of the peoples would not bring an independent Czech state. It wouldn't bring a, you know, Czechoslovakia, which only lasts till 1993, despite what John McCain thinks. It doesn't come till 1918. After World War I, but in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you know, everybody says, well, you know, what if we have a independent Galicia, or what if we, you know, Poland is independent, and the parts of Russian and Austrian Poland will be independent. But these are pipe dreams, and national awareness and great power politics will mean that this isn't going to happen until later. Poland becomes independent in 1918 for reasons that you already know, and that the wind, the chill of reaction, I mean, revolution, reaction, repression, is what really happens, and that's the theme running through the whole thing, besides the big hopes of the spring of 1848, and the kind of Austrian, the Austrian imperial system run, and I'll come back and talk about Austria-Hungary quite a bit, run in German in the polyglot Austrian-Hungarian Empire, where there are at least 15 major languages, will be the story of Austria-Hungary in the 1850s. And of course, the Hungarians get separate status, equal status in principle, as of 1867. And of course, one of the strange, not strange, but one of the interesting things about the Austro-Hungarian period is that it's in 1848 that Franz Joseph becomes emperor of Austria-Hungary. And he is in power until 1916. He is around even longer than Victoria, than Queen Victoria. And I mean, the world changes in such dramatic ways between 1848 and 1916. When I was younger than you, I was in Vienna for the first time, and I was sitting in some, you know, coffee shop, as one does there, in a cafe, and this very old man started talking to me. And he had actually seen, when he was young, had seen Franz Josef. And that was the most amazing thing for me, to actually meet somebody who had seen, when he was a boy, Franz Josef. I mean, that's just extraordinary continuity. But anyway, that's another story. Austria-Hungary is another story, and it's an interesting one. And that we're going to come back to, but I can't do that now. We've got to go back to the question of England. But also, and another of the, I mean, of the legacies of this is that, you know, after this tide of reaction, what it does is it sends waves of political refugees to places like this. Not New Haven so much, but yeah, there were some Italians end up in New Haven, Italian political refugees in that period. But lots of Germans, who were of course thrown out of the German states and had better not come back, they end up where? They end up in Philadelphia or in New York. And lots of Irish, who I'm going to talk about in a minute, ends up in obvious places, Boston, New York, those two above all, but also Philadelphia. And so the glacial wave of repression sends these people, a lot of them, to the United States. That itself is an interesting story. So although the revolutions of 1848 failed, and you should read about that, please do. God, I love this stuff, talking about this. The political legacies that they left are extremely important. And these demands for political rights would be something that would last for a very long time. And again, to repeat and to end this little part of what we're doing, oh my goodness. That German unification would come under very different auspices than that of the revolutionaries of 1848, what they wanted, and that the King of Prussia rejects this crown offered from the gutter, as he called it, to unify Germany under a liberal monarchical auspices. That ain't going to happen, and it doesn't. Okay, there's revolution in all these places in 1848, the big wave, but why not in Britain? Why not? You probably already know some of the answers. Now, the context, there are really two major contexts in all of this. The first is that the Reform Act of 1832 opens the drawbridge, puts down the drawbridge, and opens it to more voters. More people can vote now. Again, voting was based upon property qualification. Fergus O'Connor, who was an Irish Chartist, and I'll talk about it in a minute. He didn't even have the right to he is not disbarred, but he's really thrown out of Parliament because he doesn't make enough money in order to actually qualify to vote himself. You could vote if you paid X number of pounds in shillings in taxes. And so what happens is 1832 opens up the drawbridge, and more people can vote. The political arena expands a little bit, and the same thing happens in France in 1830. As you know, in France, the Revolution of 1830 doubled the number of people that could vote, but it still leaves lots of people on the outside looking in. And in 1867, they would pass a second reform bill that lets more people in. And in 1884, they pass another one that lets almost everybody in, except for, I think, domestic servants and maybe rural proletarians. I can't remember exactly. But so what the political arena is expanding. And the point of this is it's expanding through reform, that Britain reforms, and that the self-image, the self-identity of the free-born Englishman, tracing, you know, more or less, at least in the imaginary, antecedents back to June 15th, 1215, at Runnymede, near London, the idea that the free-born Englishman has rights and that we British citizens, our identity, we reform. We don't rebel. And clearly, as I will demonstrate in a minute, drawing on the work of John Belcher and other people too, that what happens in 1848 is when there might have been a revolutionary moment in Britain, that France has sneezed and Europe is catching a cold, as they like to say over and over again, it doesn't come to Britain. But that British national identity, like all national identities, have to be systematically reinvented and reconstructed. And that this happens in 1848 and subsequent years as well. That the sense that we are respectable, and respectability I've written up on the board, that respectability means reform and not revolution. Now, and that the aristocracy of labor, who were craftsmen, and artisans slash craftsmen, who could be seen walking through Hyde Park with their ladies on their arms, wearing suits, of all things, on Sundays, that bourgeois respectability had a political aspect of it too. And so in 1848, Britain does not rebel. Now the other, and I'll more about this in a minute, the other context is, of course, Chartism, which you should read about. Now, Chartist campaign, there were campaigns to get ordinary people to sign an enormous charter with millions and millions of names. There's the two big waves in the 1830s and 40s. And what they do is they sign and they say, oh, humble, we the humble poor, we ordinary people, we entreat you, you know, big time lords, property owners of great distinction who are representing a property in Parliament, we entreat you to give us political rights. And they bring these petitions, these huge petitions, they bring them on wagons signed by zillions of people, many of whom can only mark an X instead of write their names. And they bring them to Parliament in the rain, as always. And Parliament says, gee, thanks a lot, we don't want to see that. And then they say, oh, well, we'll do it again. Oh, great lords, give us political rights. And so they sign. You know, they don't pick up their blunderbusses, they sign. In 1830, the French middle class was more than happy to turn the artisans loose on the street to fight their battles for them for political reform. In Delacroix's famous painting, Liberty Leads the People, the bourgeois with his top hat, it doesn't have any, in this romantic picture, romanticized a view of revolution, does not have any place there because the bourgeoisie does not fight, unless you consider art master artisans, you know, petty bourgeois. But in England, that's never going to happen. And the Chartist campaign remains respectable. It is, you know, it's class-based to the extent that most people who sign the Chartist petitions are ordinary people. But what really they saw themselves as moral reformers. They see themselves as trying to do, and it cuts across class lines, they're trying to get the government to do the right thing to pass more reforms. The Reform Act of 1832 was passed by a conservative government because they knew that inevitably it was gonna have to be passed. Or who knows, they would create more lords in order to, and you'd have these sort of not real lords who are there so the bill gets passed. And so it's passed by a conservative government. And then everybody says, oh, well, we British, we reform, we've opened up the drawbridge, more people can vote. Now, there was a component of Chartists who were called physical force Chartists. And they, you know, they're not so sure that reform without revolution is possible. But they are a minority within the Chartist movement. They are a very small minority, the physical force Chartists. So what you've got in 1848 is you got two things that are going on. First of all, you don't have a revolution. There's this big date in April, I think it's April 10th, where there's going to be this huge march in London. So what the government does is it deputizes 25,000 men of property. They become sheriffs, they become, you know, I don't know what you call them, yeah, I guess sheriffs, I guess. And Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, who happened to be in, you know, who had not yet returned to France, he was one of those who was actually deputized as a sheriff. And so the business people in the city, which is what, you know, the financial capital of the overlooks the British Empire, was increasingly called, they come with their hunting rifles to work. And they get those file cabinets ready to barricade the door and with their rifles, and they're going to blow apart anybody who rises up and would challenge British, who would try to bring revolution to Britain. And there's 25,000 of these people. And the number of marchers was far, far small to that, and it's smaller than that, and it's a very peaceful march. There is no revolution in Britain in 1848. But if there had been a revolution, where would it come from? From where would the revolutionary ranks have come? And that is the interesting question. That's by far the most interesting question in all of this. Because what I said before about 1848 helps the British reinvent or reconfigure, reconstruct their identity, that there has to be an unwanted other there who's frightening them, who makes them convinced even more that they're doing it the right way. And I alluded before when we talked about the British identity in the 18th century, I said what the British in the 17th century, what they weren't helped determine who they thought they were. And what they weren't was absolutist. They reform. What they weren't was Catholic, they're not Catholic. And the biggest riots in the 18th century were the Gordon riots, which were anti-Catholic riots. They are not the French, not at all. France has a centralized state, and France is full of Catholics. And many of the Protestants who had left France after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685 come not just to the Netherlands, but come to Britain as well. So this may have already tipped you off on who is the unwanted, dangerous other in the British, particularly upper class, but not just upper class imaginary. And they are the Irish, the Irish. And so what happens in 1848 and the subsequent years is that British nationalism is redefined again or re-infused with a sense of what we are not, and we are not Catholic, and we are not Irish. And so if there was going to be a revolution in April or any other month in 1848, the components would be, from the point of view of the upper classes and from the police, the Irish and groups of physical force Chartists or revolutionaries who might join forces. Now, Chartists look to Irish to get them to sign the big petitions. They see them as allies. And remember, because of the Irish famine, potato famine, in the 1840s, that tens of thousands of Irishmen, hundreds of thousands of Irishmen, indeed, I think that I have it in the book somewhere, but the number of people who leave Ireland in the 1840s is in the millions, along with all those who just simply die, you know, die in the fields. And they go to where? They go to the United States, and they go to England, particularly Liverpool. That's why Liverpool, this has nothing to do with anything, rien à voir avec, but the Liverpool soccer team is very much perceived as, you know, a Catholic team, in the way that in Glasgow, that the Celtics are the Catholic team, because so many Irish immigrants went to Glasgow and to Scotland, and the Rangers are the Protestant team. Very anti-Catholic, and that's why, you know, these people were brawling in 1900. They played before 100,000 people in 1900, 100,000 people at a soccer game in about 1900, and they hate each other's guts, and they still do. So all these Irish are going to London also, and they live in the Irish neighborhoods. And so from the point of view of the ruling classes, and from the point of view of British nationalism, and from the point of view of the police, the possibility was there that the Irish Confederation, who are extremely militant. One of the important Irish leaders, Daniel O'Connor, Daniel O'Connell, who is in the book, he dies in 1847. But you've got these people that are far more militant, who believe in the only way, many of them believe that the only way Ireland is ever going to be independent is by rising up and rebelling. And that's what happens, isn't it? That's what eventually happens. So they were right about that. But what if they start rebelling in 1848? And what if you had, for example, you had your basic Peterloo Massacre, as they called it, playing on the word Waterloo, where the, you know, British troops shoot down well-dressed demonstrators in Manchester. What is it, 1817 or 1816, 1817, I don't remember. What if people who said, we ain't ever going to get anywhere if we don't do what our French colleagues have done, and that is take arms against these people. So there is a potential for an alliance between militants in the physical force Chartist movement, other radicals, and members of the Irish Confederation. Now, because it never happens, I mean, there are a few marches, there's a few skirmishes, but basically the only news is no news, does not mean that this wouldn't have a big effect on the reinvention of British nationalism, British self-identity. And what do I mean by that? Here, one of the interesting things is that John Belcher told me a long time ago on a train in Germany, from coming back from a conference in Würzburg, that there were more boxes of documents in the public record office about the surveillance of ships coming into the ports of Portsmouth and above all Liverpool than there were any other documents about any other aspect of 1848. Why? What are they doing? Where is the potential insurgency or infusion of militants for Irish coming from? It's coming from the United States. And one of the interesting things about this, and you could see also in the time of the Troubles, you know, in the 1970s, I was in Ireland, ironically, when it all started up again in 1969, when at a time they were really worried about the IRA, and there was a lot to worry about then, the IRA was getting all sorts of money from Irish pubs in New York and Boston. Just tons of money, big bucks, all the time, to buy weapons. In 1848, one of the interesting things that Belcher and other people have discovered is that the real Irish militants, the most committed, were Irish immigrants from Ireland living in Boston and New York. And what they had done is taken the notion of American liberty, in quotes, and saying, all right, our role will be that of the French Revolution to carry liberty in principle across the borders and free Europe from nobles, from priests, et cetera, et cetera. And what we will do as Irish, first generation Irish, living in New York and Philadelphia and Boston and maybe Connecticut too, is we will raise money and we will make Irish independence, and we will achieve this with violence, with guns. And so every ship that came into any port that was coming from the United States was thoroughly searched for weapons and for money. And so these Irish immigrants to the United States were the most militant, arguably, within the Irish a political movement for independence. Now, for one thing, they had more means. Some of them had come to the United States, maybe going through England, maybe not. But they had jobs, and the people in Ireland themselves were just starving. I mean, they were dying in the fields. They were ending up in London living with other Irishmen, which is not surprising, maintaining these kinds of patterns by county, Cork, and all this. And the Catholic Church was terribly, terribly important. In their lives, terribly, terribly important as, you know, means of charity and all of this. But what it meant for the upper classes is that the unwanted other, Catholic, remember in 1798 they tried to ally with the French. What happens in World War I? Roger Casement, who is an Irish militant, who is absolutely against the exploitation of workers in Peru and in Africa and everywhere else. Roger Casement, he ends up being sent off with a little boat off a submarine off the coast of Kerry, and he tries to stop the Easter insurrection. And of course, he's arrested within about 25 minutes and hung later. But what he had tried to do was organize in prisoner of war camps in Germany Irish militants to fight the good fight and to free Ireland. So there was always this was again looking later, but there was always this potential fear among the British upper classes is that they, these Catholics, who are no longer just across the channel, they're not, you know, over in Ireland across a very choppy, gray, freezing, you know, sea. They are living in Liverpool in huge, huge numbers. They are living in London in even bigger numbers, and they are there, and they are dangerous, and if they ally with these dissatisfied workers from the Chartist movement, all hell is going to break out. And so during the next time, and I don't have much time at all, but just it didn't even use this. Well, anyway, you see the point. This potential alliance never occurs. But one of the interesting things about the reinvention or the reconstruction of British identity, self-identity, and it's one shared not just by nobles and big-time gentry, but by ordinary workers, Tory workers. We tended to call them dismissively, those of us who couldn't stand Margaret Thatcher, and always were amazed to go through, you know, in working-class parts of Britain and see these miserable council houses when these big pictures of Margaret Thatcher or the royal family, you know, Anyway, it's just amazing. But these Tory workers, not just Tory workers, but they see themselves as respectable, they see themselves as British, and they increasingly see this sort of unwanted enemy within, Catholic enemy within, as the Irish. And the newspapers are full of cartoons and caricatures of the Irish, who are portrayed invariably as drunken, as stupid, and as lazy. Paddy, P-A-D-D-Y, becomes, for the caricaturist in British newspapers in 1848 and subsequent years, Paddy is portrayed as the unwanted other who is a threat to and has no place being in except to do menial jobs or as a factory operative if they maintain respectability and don't trot out their Irishness too much. And so if anyone wants to know why these issues become so extraordinarily bitter in almost any time you can think of, Ulster in the 70s, Ulster in the 80s, I mean the 1970s and 1980s, or even into the 1990s, or Ireland in 1916, 1848 plays a major role in that. Now, this is not to say that all people who saw themselves as British were necessarily, nasty, aggressive people. But it does simply remind us, and here again I counsel Linda Colley's book called Britons as a very eloquent summary of all of this, that part of the construction of any kind of identity, and I'll talk more about this when I talk about Eastern Europe and Central Europe, is what you're not, and what you're not for the British in 1848. Afraid of catching this cold coming from the continent was, again, you are not French and you are not Catholic. And this, if anything, was going to further sour the relations between Irish and British authorities, particularly given the fact that the British Protestants own the land in Ireland. I was someplace the other day and I heard a talk, I was in New York the other day and I heard a talk and saw some pictures of these marvelous kind of called mass slabs or mass rocks that were in rural Ireland where priests in the 17th and 18th century and in the 16th century for that matter, at the end of the 16th century, said mass in secret. Using these slab rocks that they happened to find as altars, because being practicing your religion was illegal, and the Protestants have the law on their side, and they own the land anyway. So 1848, there was no revolution in Britain in 1848. Clearly why this is not the case. It's almost surprising to think that they could have imagined an alliance between the Irish Confederation and other Irish groups and physical force Chartists. But 1848 has another role to play in British identity, and that I've tried to convey to you today. Have a wonderful weekend. See you on Monday. Bye.